Well, good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. We've got a great turnout. There are a couple seats inside if you're looking for them, and we're actually going to order a couple more lunches. So if you haven't gotten one, more will be coming. Again, thank you all for joining us. I'm Nate Kazmarek. I'm the director of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. We're happy to be here in Dirksen Senate Office Building to host this conversation about executive budgets and the Congress. At the outset, I'd like to thank Senator Ron Johnson and his HISGAC staff for their kindness in hosting us in their hearing room today. Article 1 Initiative often notes that the Constitution begins with the legislative branch. Far from casual placement, the ordering follows the framers' design and their expectation that Congress would be the dominant branch. Proof of this is in the powers that it has been given. Madison wrote in Federalist 58 that the Congress's power of the purse was, quote, the most complete and effectual weapon with which any Constitution can arm the immediate representatives of the people for obtaining a redress of every grievance and for carrying into effect every just and salutary measure. Yet each year, the modern Congress waits for the executive branch to complete and deliver its annual budget before beginning its own formal process. Why has this sequence developed? What is gained by the executive branch going first in the process by preparing extensive budget priorities that, for the last few decades, have been largely ignored once announced? To answer these questions and to offer their own important insight, we've gathered a great moderator and panelists today. Full bios for each of them have been provided to you on the website and the emails for today's event. I will quickly provide abbreviated versions of their bios. Our moderator is Ann DeCesaro, who is the Republican Staff Director for the Worker and Family Support Subcommittee for the House Ways and Means Committee. Before working in Congress, she spent a number of years at OMB and the Social Security Administration. She received her bachelor's degree from St. Mary's College and her master's degree from Johns Hopkins University. Next to her, we are also happy to have with us Steve Redburn, who is a professorial lecturer in public policy and public administration at George Washington University. Dr. Redburn is also a professorial lecturer in the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy, where he teaches a course on the institutions and processes of federal budgeting. He has over 25 years of experience as a senior government official at OMB and HUD. His BA was from Pennsylvania State University, and his PhD in political science was from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Last but not least is Molly Reynolds, who is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Dr. Reynolds is the author of the book, Exceptions to the Rule, The Politics of Filibuster Limitations in the U.S. Senate. And she supervises the maintenance of Brookings' long-running resource on the first branch of the government titled Vital Statistics on Congress. Her AB was in government from Smith College, and her PhD was in political science and public policy from the University of Michigan. Before we get started, you should note that we will have time for Q&A at the end of the program, so please be thinking about the questions you'd like to ask. One other logistical note is we don't have a handheld mic here in the hearing room. So when you do ask questions, please ask them loudly and we will repeat them from the panel for our recording. With that, thank you all for joining us. And Anne, the panel is yours.
Well, thank you everyone for being here today. It's not often that as a non-lawyer I get to hang out with like lawyers to the Federalist Society, so I appreciate them tackling this issue today. I want to thank our panelists too, and without further ado, I think I'm going to turn it over to Steve to make some opening comments, and then we'll get the discussion going, and please be thinking about what your questions are. Thanks.
Great. As you heard, my career is in the executive branch of the U.S. federal government, but I've been retired for a while now, and that's given me time to do a lot of international work. So I've just back from talking to people at OECD, for example, about their budget process, and in Paris about the French budget process. And the comparative perspective is actually very useful in understanding the U.S. budget process and its strengths and weaknesses. One thing that is in common throughout the world, in every country, the executive necessarily takes the lead in formulating the annual budget. This is true not only in countries with Westminster-style parliamentary systems like the UK, but even in countries like France or the US, where there's a presidential system where there are constitutionally defined independent legislative authorities. In the U.S., in 1921, Congress passed the Budget and Accounting Act, requiring the executive to prepare a detailed, comprehensive annual budget request. After the Taft Commission, most of you are too young to remember this, after the Taft Commission found that this was required in order to ensure that budgets and policies were fiscally sustainable. The executive has developed an elaborate process supported by strong analytical capability to sort through and integrate a complex array of policy considerations in formulating the annual budget. How many of you have read the budget appendix that comes out every February, or almost every February? It's full of detailed information. reflecting that kind of analysis. The capacity to find and apply relevant evidence in order to judge performance of programs, how well they're working, to develop scenarios and risk assessments, and to assess the costs and benefits of alternatives is present in the executive branch. The robust and lengthy budget development process led each summer in the executive agencies first, and then beginning in September, after Labor Day, by OMB's career examiners, integrates and prioritizes spending and tax options based on both immediate and long-term political and policy objectives. Executive domination of budget formulation provides a single point of leadership and accountability. In some periods, a new president will have a clear national electoral mandate for certain spending and revenue priorities. You could see that at the beginning of the Obama administration, for example, on health care and the need for a recovery act and for financial services reform. And those can be presented then to Congress for consideration. Congress, on the other hand, lacks the capacity to think systematically or systemically, or strategically in a coherent way about budget processes. While the executive has one head and an integrated brain, Congress has 535 heads and perhaps as many brains. But the inability of Congress to think and act systemically and strategically arises from the nature of a representative legislative body whose members respond necessarily to narrow constituencies and to special interests. Because this incapacity is fundamental, it's institutional, it's in the structure, it therefore cannot be remedied by improvements in staffing levels, reorganizing committee jurisdictions, or tweaking congressional procedures. Congress's main roles in the budget process have been to enact detailed appropriations in response to the administration's requests. And in the budget appendix, you'll see laid out for the appropriators the language that they can enact or choose to modify, bracketing the parts that should be deleted and highlighting the parts that the administration proposes to add. So there's a blueprint in great detail for the appropriators to begin their work. Similarly, in the administration's request for tax policy changes, including spending through special tax provisions that favor particular sources and uses of income, like which we call tax expenditures. Congress has an important role to play there. And importantly, Congress provides oversight of budget execution. So those are the traditional roles that Congress plays. The 1974 Congressional Budget Act attempted to add to these responsibilities the task of annually constructing a comprehensive congressional budget. Many saw this as a necessary response and counterweight to executive overreach and abuses of the process by President Nixon. The most important achievement of the 1974 Act was creation of the Congressional Budget Office, which under leadership by the amazing Alice Rivlin and her successor, Rudy Penner, institutionalized Congress's independent capacity to estimate the costs of budgetary options and to publish those costs of legislation and of legislative alternatives. But the congressional process does not support comprehensive, coherent budget formulation. While Congress does have high-powered analytical engines in GAO and CBO and the staff of the Joint Tax Committee, and the CRS, which does remarkable work on tax policy analytically. These are not charged with developing plans for raising and using resources, budgeting. Congress can't replicate the massive effort of the executive to produce and justify a complete prioritized plan for spending and a plan to finance it. Today's process, however, is not much help to leaders facing an array of complex challenges with limited resources and unable to sustain the spending commitments that have already been made. Among other flaws, it encourages a short-term, myopic, stovepiped approach to the budget and puts most mandatory spending and tax policy on autopilot. The path forward for the budget process involves fixing clear responsibility for fiscal policies with the president and a framework that is more strategic and more farsighted and makes better use of evidence about which policies make the best use of limited resources. As recommended by a joint study committee of the National Academies of Sciences and Public Administration in 2010, and I was the study director for this, for example, the president should be asked regularly to present a plan to show how current and proposed spending commitments can be paid for over the long term, a plan for fiscal sustainability. As in most OECD countries, the annual budget should be considered in a multi-year framework. This has become the norm around the world, not just in the OECD countries, the advanced economies. In a framework that shows how over a period of several years, targets can be established for spending and revenues and for budget savings to meet prescribed deficit and debt reduction goals, either through spending reductions or tax increases. And as the late Paul Posner and I have written, the executive's process, which expends much of its effort on incremental changes in spending levels from one year to the next and marginal policy questions, should devote more of its energy and attention to larger policy goals and alternative strategies to use resources much more productively to achieve those. A change to what we have called portfolio budgeting or budgeting for national goals. One of the features of this is that it would bring tax expenditures into the regular review process for major policy objectives, along with other spending, along with what is currently considered spending. The executive has the analytical capacity and the centralized focus needed to make this change whenever it chooses to do so. When the time is right, a stronger budget process could help a president committed to responsible fiscal policies provide leadership on the budget to which Congress can respond. However, given the constitutional limits on executive power, a stronger executive process could only take us so far. As political scientists Roy Myers and Irene Rubin have pointed out, the way forward requires cooperation and accommodation between the executive and Congress. In my view, the process change most likely to facilitate this would be in the form of a joint budget resolution adopted at the beginning of each new Congress. So it would be a two-year or three-year budget resolution, and embodying a prior negotiated agreement between the president and congressional leaders on revenue and spending targets for that period, and embodying certain major budget priorities. This wouldn't require a policy agreement, but it would require agreement on what the priorities are that are going to be the greatest focus in the budget process. If Congress is able to strengthen and rationalize its own process, it can become a competent and responsive partner for the president in setting budget priorities. And that's the challenge that I'm happy to hand over to my colleague, Molly Reynolds.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you all for being here. So my job today is to stick up for Congress in the budget process. Congress doesn't always make it easy for me to do this, but I'm going to make several points about sort of why I think it's important to keep Congress as the center of this process and not to further delegate authority or power over the budget process to the executive branch. And I'll start by talking a little bit about some of what Nate mentioned in his introductory introductory remarks and the sort of constitutional responsibility of Congress in this area. The Constitution explicitly grants Congress the power to levy taxes and provides that money can only be spent pursuant to laws passed by Congress. This was a choice made by the founders, explicitly designed to limit the power of the executive. I won't go too far into the pre-constitutional history here, but its choice was inspired in part by a long struggle that the founders had watched play out in Britain between the king and the British Parliament. This choice to vest legislatures with spending power in the United States actually dates before the drafting of the constitutions. The Constitution, there were seven states that contained who had constitutions containing provisions requiring appropriations by their state legislatures. The Articles of Confederation also gave Congress a limited power to appropriate money. And as Nate pointed out, in their advocacy for the Constitution, the Federalists argued that giving Congress the power to appropriate money was an important check on the power of the president, especially in the context of the president's ability to declare war. And that there was this idea that these decisions about how money should be spent should be made closer to the people, in the hands of the people's elected representatives. In the quote from Federalist 58 that Nate read in his intro, which I also have down in front of me, Madison also argued that this power of the purse is a really important source of broader congressional power and authority. It's not just about determining exactly how much money is spent, but it's also an important lever that Congress can and does pull to influence broader policy. And I think there's no better place to see this in the contemporary budget process than in the use of riders and appropriations bills. That these are really ways to enact substantive policy through the spending process beyond just determining spending levels. As Steve mentioned in his remarks, I think it's also important to reflect on sort of the role of executive overreach in getting us to our current budget process and the broader challenges that we've seen Congress face in a period after which it has delegated significant, some may say, excessive authority to the executive branch. So as Steve mentioned, a major reason that Congress redesigned the budget process in the first place in the early 1970s was in order to check overreach by the executive in the form principally of impoundments on the part of President Nixon. This was part of a broader trend in that period in the early to mid-1970s of Congress trying to set up ways to check the power of the executive branch. We've seen some of these come back in various forms in recent years, things like the War Powers Resolution, Congress's ability to vote to disapprove of arms sales, that sort of thing. But so this is an investment that Congress made in its own authority in the early and mid 70s. But since then, Congress has largely sort of delegated a lot more authority to the executive branch, and has learned that the consequences of doing so mean that it's quite difficult to get that power back once it has given it over to the executive branch. So if we're thinking about trying to ensure that Congress is capable of fulfilling its constitutional responsibilities, doing so by giving more authority that will be difficult to claw back to the executive branch, I think raises some concerns. In addition, when we think, for me at least, when I think about the problems that plague our current budget process, it's not clear to me that a more executive-driven budget process would actually solve the problems that we actually have. And I'm going to sort of walk through a number of reasons why I think this is true. So one is that there's some political science research on the contemporary period that suggests that in our current political system, the president, and I don't just mean the current president, I mean this president and several presidents before him, are increasingly polarizing figures in that when the president takes a position on a particular issue, it has the effect of polarizing the parties in Congress more than they otherwise would be on the issue if the president hadn't gotten involved. So it causes members of the president's party to really dig in favor of his position, and it causes members of the other party to dig in opposition to that. And so further inserting the president in the budget process, I think, would run the risk of having that dynamic plague the budget process even more than it already does. There's also the issue of the punctuality of the president's budget proposal. So Congress is not great at keeping to its own budget deadlines. The president, in terms of transmitting the president's budget, has also increasingly done that on a delayed schedule, particularly in the first year of a new administration. In terms of, so one proposal that Steve didn't discuss, but that some folks make in this context is the idea of making the president's budget the reversion point, or the point to which spending levels revert if Congress fails to take action. This generally, and other issues related to things like automatic continuing resolutions, tend to privilege those who want to obstruct and make it easier for those who don't want to see action just to hold out in favor of those who do. Steve did mention the question of perhaps a joint resolution, a joint budget resolution in lieu of the concurrent resolution we already have. I think in periods of unified party control, that might work quite well. In periods of divided party control, I think it would exacerbate some of the challenges that we currently have. The idea that a Congress where one or both parties are controlled by a party other than the White House, it would be potentially quite difficult to come to compromise on a joint budget resolution. When we think about sort of our long-term spending challenges, and we think about entitlement spending in particular, it's not clear to me that an executive-driven budget process actually helps meet our entitlement spending challenges better than a congressional process does. And part of that is because the broader political incentives that make it difficult to deal with our long-term entitlement challenges aren't necessarily better addressed by a president in a very partisan era. Yes, the president can only be president for two terms, but our increasing levels of partisan team play and the idea that you have one partisan team against the other partisan team really incentivizes even a president in his second term to do things that are good for the party. And that I think that that would also present, present a challenge. In terms of the analytical imbalance that Steve discussed between Congress and the executive, I don't. Steve said that he doesn't necessarily think that better congressional staffing is a solution to that challenge. I think that I would disagree. I completely agree with Steve's perspective that one of the greatest successes of the Congressional Budget Act was the creation of the Congressional Budget Office. We have seen staff levels in the CBO decline over time, not uniformly. They've sort of bounced around a little bit, but certainly they haven't grown in accordance with the increasing complexity of the federal budget issues that Congress faces. In terms of committee staff levels, especially on the other side of the Capitol in the House, we've seen those decline quite significantly, including a very large drop after the 1994 elections. And so to me, the solution or the answer to an analytical imbalance between Congress and the president isn't just to sort of throw up our hands and say that some of these functions are better performed in the executive branch. It's to create a better resourced Congress. It's also the case that some folks have argued that the quality of the information that comes to Congress from OMB has declined over time, in part because Congress and the executive branch have asked OMB to do more and more things, and they themselves face capacity problems. And so if we think about the quality of information that they can provide Congress, that's also a challenge. And then the last thing I'll say is that it is often reported that the president's budget proposal is irrelevant or dead on arrival. This is true going back to the mid-80s. This is not a new phenomenon. But I will say that the president's budget still provides a very important agenda-setting function for Congress. Anyone who's ever staffed or sat through a budget hearing with executive branch officials of various kinds know that that process that happens in Congress each year really is driven by the transmission of the president's budget. And I would also argue that Congress has been at least somewhat successful in adapting its contemporary appropriations process to the political challenges that it faces. So I'd point to things like the Congress's kind of experiment with minibus appropriations bills last year as a way of kind of meeting the politics where they were and figuring out how to get some things done. Sometimes it can be hard to hold in our heads that Congress had its most successful appropriations year in about a decade in the same year that we got a historically long government shutdown. But those things are both true. And so sort of looking for ways in which Congress has been able to figure out how to work in the face of partisan challenges, I think, is also an important part of this conversation. So I'll stop there.
So I just wanted to, I told each of them they would have the opportunity to rebut the other person if there was anything that popped up, and then we'll jump into some questions. So Steve, did you have some, you know, preliminary thoughts after listening to Molly?
Well, I'd like to violently disagree with Molly, but it's difficult because I think we're in agreement on most of these points. And I certainly agree that, and imagine you do too, that it would be good to have more congressional staff, right? How many of you have too little to do right now? I didn't disagree with that. With regard to OMB's capacity, I would just point out that it's not just OMB that puts together the president's budget. You know, they can marshal the tremendously deep analytical resources of the departments and the agencies, and those departments spend a lot of time especially during the spring and the summer. With their own budget processes, integrating a whole bunch of information to try to figure out the best way to support the president's administration's priorities and address major challenges. So it's really the whole executive branch that's up against a congressional process that is, it's not that there's not strong analytical resources in the Congress. I think I made clear, I believe there are, and it's very useful to have CBO as an analytical partner with OMB in a lot of these more technical discussions. The problem is that Congress doesn't have a process strong enough to integrate, and probably never will because of its structure, to integrate all of this analysis and information and to set priorities, whether it's based on good information or just pure political considerations. There's no process to pull it all together into a coherent plan for the nation's spending and taxation and revenues. So it's just not possible, in my view. And that's what we see around the world. And that doesn't mean there couldn't be opportunities earlier in the process for Congress to be more involved. And a good example is if there were prior agreement on certain priorities that needed to be addressed, and that took the form of a joint budget resolution that included fiscal targets, as is true in most countries now, medium-term expenditure framework is the standard terminology, then that would give Congress an opportunity to weigh in prior to the start of the annual process, at least in the second year of a Congress. So that's one example.
Molly, any thoughts?
All I would say is that I completely agree that the analytical capacity of the executive branch in this area extends far beyond OMB. And I think that the sort of overall concern that I have about moving towards a more executive-driven budget process than the one that we already have is that once we go further down that road, it becomes even harder for Congress to try to reassert its authority in areas that it wants to try and do so, because it's very hard to get power back once you've given it away.
So staying consistent with the whole Article 1, you know, power of the purse perspective, if you go over to the museum, if the newspapers are still there, you can find a newspaper and pull it out. And on the front page of one of them is the entire federal budget. And this is back in like the 1800s. And so if we think back to even before then, when our founders were sitting down and deciding these things, the things they had in mind were, you know, tyranny, a ruler across the ocean directing them what they should be doing. And so finally, yes, we are going to take control of our own money. Did they envision that we would have such a complicated maze of policies and spending. And, you know, if Molly, channeling our founders, if they woke up today to look at our budget process, what do you think they would say?
Well, the founders did not, I don't think, envision one nearly as complicated federal and as expansive a federal government as we have now. I mean, we had a much smaller country at that point. But two, and perhaps equally as importantly from my perspective, the founders didn't envision our partisan politics of today either. They did not, I don't think, imagine a world with the very strong political parties as we have them now. And as I hoped to convey in my opening remarks, and I think Steve touched on this as well, that the partisan politics of this are inescapable. And so it's not just about sort of the increasing size and complexity of the federal government that we've gotten away from a world that the founders might understand, but also the way that our political system has changed.
Did you want to say anything?
That's right. There was no budget process as we know it for the first century or so of our country, and around the world, is budgeting as we think of it today is a modern invention. Thus, it was not till 1921 that we had an executive budget process that pulled all the agency requests together and sorted and ranked them and made them fit together in the way we think of it today. Perhaps noteworthy that during that early period, even though there was no organized budget process of that sort, the budget was balanced most of the time, whereas now we have an elaborate process, and of course the budget is never balanced, or hardly ever. Although when I was there, it was balanced 4 years in a row, no thanks to me.
So I want to talk, okay, so both of you sort of talked about things that we could do to fix the modern process. I want to take us back and talk about sort of the fiscal cliff and we had the super committee process. I'm a authorizer of a mandatory program, so I want to talk about that, and we can talk about discretionary appropriations next. But, you know, we set up this structure because with the super committee, so the concept here was that we were facing a fiscal cliff and needed to have a structure in place that would force some sort of action, some sort of agreement, some sort of something to happen. And that the consequence would be so bad that we definitely would get a deal. Okay, and the consequence was that we would have these across the board cuts, which are now sequester. We thought that was so bad that we would find this deal, and we didn't. And so what, even if we continue to talk about like, oh, well, we should reform the process and maybe we should have, you know, follow the minibus approach and combine some things, or we should, you know, do multi-year budgeting. Does that really mean anything? Like, is there a way to retake this process? You know, based on this sort of recent example, right now we're operating without a cap steal. So that sort of cap structure is sort of the kind of multi-year budgeting that you're talking about, where, you know, according to current law, the president put out a budget that said, you know, relative to the caps, this is what would happen. But you don't see a lot of motivation. I mean, they were working on a cap steal. How do we incentivize this process to actually happen?
Of course, the budget process is a captive of the larger political process. And when there's a period of intense, even bitter political division, given the constitutional structure, by design was set up to make it necessary for the president and Congress to work together in order to enact laws, you're going to have difficulties. You're not going to solve that problem through budget process reform. But of course, other countries also have deep political divisions, and they have managed to enact multi-year budget frameworks, not detailed budgets. That's still an annual appropriations type process. But, you know, I think it is feasible. It's easy to imagine that we could do that here. But it'll take some work.
I think one really important lesson that we should take away from not just the experience with the super committee, but with other experiences, say, since the early 1980s with efforts to reach big long-term budget deals, is that budget deals are often much better at forcing future compliance with something where there's already an agreement in place than they are about forcing an agreement where there isn't one to be had. And that's sort of the approach that the super committee, the fiscal cliff, tried to take, this idea that folks would find an agreement if the consequences of doing so were so big. But it's really hard to force people to agree to something when there's no sort of middle ground, no common ground to be found. And one perpetual challenge for Congress in thinking over the medium to long term, not just in budgeting, but in all kinds of issues, is that a current Congress can only bind future Congresses to the extent that the future Congress doesn't want to undo what a previous Congress did. And so, and that's sort of what we've seen with this series of caps deals, is that, you know, we had these caps in place. I actually think the cap structure has played a really important role in structuring our series of budget negotiations. So the idea that we have a cap for defense and a cap for non-defense has sort of created a given environment in which these decisions get made. And it'll be interesting to me to see what happens after the Budget Control Act expires. But in terms of thinking about keeping the caps as a limiting factor, that's only as good as Congress's interest in doing so. And when Congress is able to actually find bipartisan agreement on not doing that, there's very little that's going to stop them from changing their mind.
Maybe a better experience to reflect on, and if you want to be hopeful about the future, would be the 1990 budget summit and budget agreement, which was enacted by bipartisan majorities in House and Senate. And it included budget caps for 5 years on discretionary spending, which held for the most part for that period of time. It wasn't quite as challenging a economic and fiscal environment then as it has been lately. And also the PAYGO process was a product of that agreement, and the credit reform change in the treatment of credit programs. So the number of important processes reforms were enacted that have had a salutary effect, I would argue, on the process, a disciplining effect on the process. So maybe that's a better experience to consider than the more recent one, or at least another one to think about.
So, Steve, I want to push you on kind of the executive branch perspective. So while you talk about, sort of one figurehead, lots of brains within it, he's talked, too, about this kind of small-p politics that goes on even within folks who are supposed to be aligned within an executive branch, who are supposed to be going in the same direction. And is there value to the process? Not just the end result of what, gets translated to Congress, but in that process that they go through of, the starting with the letter that goes out from OMB and from the president saying, like, here's our targets. Every year it's about a 5% cut, right? I think it's almost the same letter every year. The agencies get it. They go through their process, but also that examining of, the current state of things. And a lot of the budget that is being produced is also retrospective, right? It's what have we done in the last year? Where are we right now? And so that examination process. But can you talk about sort of like, one figurehead, but we've got lots of brains, lots of people, you got secretaries who have their own ideas of things, and the process that, the budget does to bring them all together so that you can have negotiations.
Sure. And as a veteran of that process, yeah. And OMB yourself, yeah. you know that it's an exciting, exhilarating process every year of negotiation with the behind closed doors. It's not transparent, but there's a lot of examination of how well things are working and what the best way is to achieve the president's priorities and what should have priority. And at the end of it, in the October and November prior to Thanksgiving, the biggest issues are brought by the examiners to the director for decision, and things get sorted out. And it's quite a remarkable, I think, a remarkable analytical political exercise, small p political exercise, to take all of that complexity and distill it down to produce a budget in that period of time every year. I would add that around the world, especially since the financial crisis in 2008, more and more countries have instituted somewhat similar processes. The general term is spending reviews, OMB has always done these spending reviews in one way or another. In the Bush years, it was the PART, the program assessment rating tool that was used to examine every program's performance and results. Now we have a framework here under the Government Performance and Results Act, Modernization Act, that sets up a set of regular routines that can be integrated with the budget process, and many departments are integrated in the budget process, especially during the summer, of strategic reviews, which are backward-looking. You know, how well are we doing in achieving what we said we were going to try to accomplish, our mission as a department? And then forward-looking, what are the risks? What are the future threats to our performance? What can we do better? And that process then informs the decision-making in the summer for that department's budget submission to OMB, which is then rigorously reviewed in hearings and so on. So the process has changed over time to include more and more performance information and more rigor, I would say, on balance, not just in this country, but in many other countries.
So picking up on that, Molly, in thinking about the Congress and their declining brain power just by the sheer decrease in number of people, you know, thinking about all this work that goes on in the executive branch on sort of the backward looking, the like, where are we, how are things going to inform the sort of future? When you think about capacity, what capacity are you looking that you think would maximize the congressional role, and what things could we lean on the executive branch a little bit more for?
Sure. So I think of this mainly in thinking about congressional committees and in thinking about the support agencies. So principally in this area, the Congressional Budget Office, though also GAO and, as Steve pointed out, CRS, which does really important analytical work as well. So ensuring that all of those support agencies are adequately staffed, I think, is important. And then in terms of thinking about the committees, some of it's about staffing levels, but some of it is also about making sure that committees are still places where people want to have long careers. So obviously, you know, you've had a long career on Ways and Means, but when we look at sort of staff tenure, there's a lot of turnover, more so in personal offices than in committees, but even on committees. And then we also sort of at the tail end of the distribution have folks who have been up here on the Hill for 30 years or what have you. But really just making sure that committees are places where folks are compensated well enough and have opportunities to grow in their jobs so that we don't lose expertise going out the door because Capitol Hill isn't a place where people sort of want to build long careers. I think making sure that folks continue to have that expertise, and you know that someone knows how to read the appendix to the president's budget when it comes up here, and that there's not just one person on your committee staff who knows how to do that.
Person is usually me.
So I'm all in favor of getting you some coworkers who are also as into the appendix and the budget justifications as you are, but just making sure again that Congress has the ability to do the work itself, so it doesn't have to either rely on the executive branch or rely on outside groups and lobbyists to give you the answers that you need to make sure that you can do it for yourselves.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something about the information that is transmitted. We've had the appendix structure for a long time. We've had, you know, sort of different presidents have tried to mold the budget submission, you know, thought about how to use it. But if you're producing a document for an audience who is not ready to receive it or knows how to use it, what good is it? And so are there places where the two sides could meet in the middle? I mean, are there things that, you know, congressional staff need to learn more about how to use budget documents and things that maybe...
I think the French have worked on this for some time now, and are particularly good at what they focus on is transparency. That is, they publish preliminary documents, which they share with Parliament earlier in the process so that they get feedback and input before all the decisions are made in detail about the president's budget or the prime minister's budget. And I think that's an example of what we could do. I think we should look for ways to get Congress more actively and directly involved in budget formulation. At the same time, you have to protect the privacy of the executive's deliberations simply because that facilitates frank discussion and speaking truth to power and so on within the executive branch, which I think has to be preserved. But I like the idea of a joint budget resolution, as I said, and that would require then an opportunity at least every 2 years at the start of a Congress for Congress to weigh in. The GPRA Modernization Act also calls for engagement by Congress in setting priorities for improving performance, and I think more could be done to take advantage of that, but a lot depends on how Congress organizes itself to engage. And sometimes, from my perspective and others who work in the executive branch, it's hard to figure out who to talk to. When you go up there, people are not listening or they haven't been around long enough to know what to ask. So it's and what committee do you go to?
Molly, we're talking a lot about staff and staff capacity. Have there been trends in member capacity over time, too, that we should be mindful of?
So it's really hard to sort of measure what we would think of as member capacity. It is true that particularly after kind of big wave elections, like the one that we just had in 2018 and the one we had in 2010, you end up with more and more members who haven't served that long in the institution. Mm-hmm. One real consequence of that right now is that there are relatively few members, particularly on the House side, who were in the institution when the budget process worked better than it does now. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, especially relevant to the conversation we were having before about the caps and the series of two-year caps deals that we've had. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what the kind of number is, but I would say a sizable majority of House members have only ever served in the House in the Budget Control Act mm-hmm. era. And so when they look at sort of what has made the process work better sometimes and worse other times, they look at the series of two-year caps deals and say, okay, that first year is terrible because we spend all this time fighting about what the caps are going to be, and it makes it really hard for us to figure out how to divide up the pie until we know how big the pie is going to be. And if we don't decide how big the pie is going to be until October, how are we supposed to get any of the work done? And then they look at the second year of the caps deal and say, okay, this has worked a little bit better, still not great, but better than the first year. And I think that is actually part of why we've seen some momentum around the idea of two-year budget resolutions, mm-hmm. because that's what members know, and that's what they've been socialized into. And mm-hmm. so, and thinking not so much about capacity, but just about how do members approach the process, yeah. and what do they know, and what have they been exposed to? I think it's really important to kind of reflect on our recent budgeting experiences and how those translate.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think we all, you know, our bosses come in with certain perspectives. Some of them have served in state legislatures and very much know the, like, oh, this thing's got to balance. And then we've got some folks who come in from a business or come in from, you know, other lines of work and, you know, are just trying to figure, you know, they're all just trying to figure out how it all works together.
Yeah, or folks who come from state legislatures where it's the norm to spend the first part of the year really only working on the budget and not doing a lot of things on the floor. And then once all that work is done, then everything shifts the floor and you're on the floor basically the whole time.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, just sort of what this idea of what members know, both from before they come mm-hmm. And what they get exposed to here. I think there's a lot of path dependence in terms of how they think things should work based on what they've been exposed
to. And then that interacts with the, you know, declining tenures of committee staff and those that have been around to go through these prior experiences. I mean, there's not many people around from the 1990, you know, budget deals and that sort of like coming together. But I've heard the stories of, you know, going to Camp David and kind of putting everybody together. Andrews Air Force Base. Okay. Yeah. I mean, in
doing that.
There
was an ice cream machine at Andrews Air Force Base, which really facilitated long discussions. Yeah.
But on a serious note, I mean, those are the types of things, those like trusting relationships between staff. We all know about those when we have, you know, a group who has been working on things. I can speak from my space. We have a lot of consistency in the staff and allows us to be very successful and kind of stay below the radar. But yeah, when you have people cycling in and out and there isn't, you know, staff to staff trust and time spent together working on things, Yeah, and members not working together on things. You can't get to agreement. That was more of a comment than a statement, or than a question. I apologize. Yes, but I also want to talk about the executive budget as a negotiating tool. So we're talking about it being hard enough for the House and the Senate to agree on a resolution to set a budget. Then you throw in like another person. Isn't there some advantage to like sort of one corner at least staking out and saying like, these are my priorities. These are the things that... I want to fund to help with that process, because if you didn't, I mean, we're having in the current example, challenges, getting the executive to lock down and to commit to things. But isn't that part of the budget process is to know where the executive sits on issues?
The problem with having it as the starting point for negotiations is that all the decisions have been made and put together in great detail at that point. I think we need a document or a process that allows Congress to weigh in when things are not fully decided. And I think the response is likely to be much greater, much more positive to that. I think of the current administration's reorganization proposals, the whole set of them, the 40-some that they submitted. And I think in virtually every case, not all cases, there was no prior consultation with anybody on the Hill about those things. So whatever good work may have gone into those, there was a sort of immediate predisposition to say, not invented here, I reject that. What sense does that make? Why didn't you come and talk to me before you put it down as a proposal? A lot of things happen like that. I think they happen in the wrong order. So fixing that is not necessarily there's no constitutional barrier to talking at an earlier stage about these things, and that's something that could be worked on. I don't know, how do you feel about that? Yeah.
No, I mean, I think there's something to that. I do see the president's budget in important ways as sort of the president's opening proposal in these ongoing negotiations. But I take Steve's point that there may be ways to increase congressional engagement in the formulation process before we get to that document that I think are worth considering.
So I'd like to open it up. You guys have been a great audience. Any questions? Otherwise, we just keep going. So hop in there. Thoughts? Yeah, somebody. I see some people pushing. So go ahead. Speak up. Speak very loudly because we don't have mics. So the question was, the federal budget impacts state budgets. And so do you take into account that impact on state budgets when doing that formulation?
There is in our federal system no institutional mechanism to coordinate between state and federal budget processes. So there's essentially no consultation or it's very, very haphazard and stovepiped. About highway funding, for example, there may be conversations between DOT and state officials about that. But it's all done in those narrow channels. There used to be some mechanisms for consultation that were institutionalized, but they've all disappeared over the years. So I think that's a real gap in our system, in contrast with other federal systems, that we don't have that sort of budgetary coordinating mechanism, not even on revenue policies, where there's obviously a lot of interaction and conflict between revenue preferences.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that the place where this matters most is actually further down the line of the process when it comes time to actually sort of make and vote on the decisions in Congress, because obviously, members think about, what's the effect that this change is going to have on my state. Governors are telling them if you do X, like that'll mean Y for our state. And so I think Steve's point about the fact that we lack an institutionalized way now to do this at the formulation stage is a real challenge. And then in some ways we're left to try to accommodate these concerns when we get to a much more
sort of political stage of the process.
As a House person, I definitely feel that when we try to send something over and then there's, you know, the governor calls the, you know, the two senators and, you know, deals off the table. Other things, yeah, go ahead.
Given the increased complexity of the budget, how do you deal with what I've always seen as an information asymmetry in that there are limitations on the ability of Congress to test the underlying assumptions and limitations on the willingness of the executive to give underlying data? So you can look at a budget from a priority perspective very quickly to look at a budget from, okay, I've got agreement on priorities, but we need to squeeze money here because this is a higher priority, seems to me to be much harder and seems to me to be two problems, the first being the executive not wanting to give over the underlying data that you need to be spot checked, and two, there being really no anything approaching any systematic mechanism for Congress to deal with that given the complexity of the current budget.
So to try to summarize and bring that for our taped audience, the question has to do with the asymmetric information there is and that the executive branch has way more information than Congress does from just looking at their documents. And there's sort of like rank order decisions that could be made or have been made but aren't necessarily reflected in the documents. And so are there ways in which we can think about that? And I think it kind of goes to the consultation earlier in the process. Maybe,
yeah,
Steve?
I'm curious. Is there a particular bad experience you've had that you're thinking of?
Nothing that struck me as egregiously bad. It's just hard to get underlying data sometimes, and there was a reluctance. Look at any time there's a cost deferment, people don't talk about it. You know, I've had to issue subpoenas to get cost data that's out of independent agencies before.
Yeah. That's surprising to me. You know, I would think that it would be, congressional justifications are often very detailed and informative documents because the agency is interested in convincing the appropriators or whoever the decision makers are that they need to fund these priorities. So usually they're very forthcoming, I would think.
I think I'm speaking to a different problem where if you're saying we all agree on the priority, it's national defense, we have to have this, the question is that figure actually right? Oh. That's what the problem is. Is that figure too high? It's very easy to have a priority disagreement politically. It's much harder to vote against, you know, the milk pond because you think there's inflated spending. That's where I'm going to, because without being able to show, literally this budget is paying $10,000 per toilet.
Yeah.
You're going to get fired as a staffer if you go and say, vote against milk on.
Well, that's why God created GAO, right? They're very powerful, and Congress can direct them. You say, you go look at this and see if there are cost overruns or what is the truth about these numbers. And CBO is also quite helpful, I think. So.
But isn't there a trust factor here, too? I mean, it sounds like, so part of the question is about, you know, not getting the information and people are afraid to share information. From my time in the executive branch, I have a lot of friends. We all know a lot of people in this town, and you want to call up and you get in trouble if you don't go through congressional affairs. Is that sort of trust piece, is that what's missing? And is that why we're...
During my career, I noticed it was harder and harder to get authorization to talk to people on the Hill or even GAO. Mm-hmm. I generally ignored that prohibition, you know, when I could get away with it. But I imagine it's gotten harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think some of it's that. I think on this question of different assumptions and trying to unpack who's making what assumption, that is sometimes like a good faith difference, and sometimes it's a difference that is really about kind of an underlying, often partisan disagreement that's being captured in different set of assumptions being made by Congress versus the executive branch. And it can be difficult to tease out exactly what's happening at any given given point in time. But it is, you're right that there is this fundamental asymmetry between the executive branch and Congress on this informational piece, and it's a it's been a challenge. The creation of CBO was designed in part to help address the challenge, but I think it's still there in important ways.
Quick follow-up on Mackenzie, your point, Steve, about yeah, you want the money. I actually had a problem in the context of we want to give you more money, give us the information you need to allocate.
Yes.
I've literally been in the room, we all agree with you on this, we want to give you more money, and not been able to get the answer of how to get more money. So I think to that point.
That's probably because the president's budget is the constraint there, and agencies are expected, they don't always do this, but they're expected to stick with the president's budget request. So they don't want to be helpful because that would be inconsistent with the president's budget.
Other president, there's one in the back.
Yeah, so you used reorganization as an example maybe of no constitutional barrier to discussion and yet didn't happen. And I don't think that's just this administration. Are there incentives or maybe incentives to not have those discussions? You talked about information getting harder to sort of have that trust. I'm curious what's causing that hang up? Because it seems, like you said, reasonable to just say, hey, we're thinking about reorganization. Here's how we would like to fund it and have that conversation instead of sort of these, oh, it's irrelevant, it's DOA, all that happens. So what's just... what do you think's going on there?
Sorry, I just got to do my job. Yep. So the question is, building off of the example of no consultation before sending up reorganization proposals, what are the incentives and disincentives to having those conversations? And is it part of it trust? And how do we rebuild some of that?
I think there's a practical problem in that often decisions aren't made until the last minute or last week or two before the budget comes out on some of these things. And once the administration has its act together, then they can consider what they should do to try to get these enacted, and by then it's time to publish them. I don't know if that's always the case, but I think that was the case to some extent here. There is some reluctance, I guess, to leak. Things will leak if you talk too widely about what you're planning to do, especially when things are unresolved within the executive branch, and you don't want those internal debates and fights to spill over into the public arena until you're ready to go. It's not an ideal world. So.
I think part of it is also that unless Congress is willing to punish the executive branch for not talking to them in the first place, what incentive does the executive branch have to talk to them in the first place? So unless Congress is willing to say, we're not going to give you any money to fund your reorganization proposal because you didn't talk to us before you floated it, then that the next time the executive branch doesn't have an incentive to come to Congress first. And so the willingness of Congress to use the powers that it has to push back against the executive branch to try to make it behave differently are a really important part of the story.
Any other questions? Sure.
So we've seen over the last century or so, a lot of delegation to work on this. Administrators use that knowledge to see that we don't know what it is. Even more recently, CFPB.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
And then they write the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, don't get their creation process. How do you see that affecting the supporting entity?
So it sounds like some of the independent, so the question is, we've got some independent agencies who don't go through the appropriations process, who are kind of independent, mostly because they have fees or collections from other places, and thoughts about bringing them into the budget process, and would that help?
That was only part of your question, oh. Yeah, delegation.
The other part of the conversation was about, or question was about delegation of powers. And as we've moved more towards regulation and more power and the sort of execution and the design of programs, are we about getting it back? Oh, okay. Just about that. All right.
Yeah. Well, that's a big, interesting, complicated question, set of questions. I don't know that I have a definitive answer to that. I think with regard to independent agencies who don't rely on appropriations because they have their own sources, I think that's a problem for the larger budget process. Not a huge problem, but I think it would be better if everybody were on the same level playing field, it seems to me, and what from the standpoint of sorting out priorities. But there are arguments for independence, and I think part of that is independence in the budget from the budget process. So that's a complicated thing to sort out, and I don't have it sorted out. And I think the answer probably varies depending on the mission of the agency and so on.
And there are different forms of being an independent agency,
that's
too.
Right.
I mean, some of them, independent from who, I think, is often the question, too. And so,
like the annual appropriations or not.
Right. And so sometimes agencies are like, I'm an independent agency. And you're like, well, you're independent only in this manner, not in,
Right.
So.
Yeah. So I think on the delegation piece, something that's important to remember is that much of why Congress has delegated power to the executive branch is because it is or was not interested in making some hard choices itself. So in some cases, it's because the executive branch, for some of the informational reasons we've talked about, is better equipped to kind of fill in some of the details and do some of the implementation work than Congress itself. But in a lot of cases, it's because Congress doesn't want to be the place that has to make the hard choices. And I'd wager that fundamental political reality isn't terribly different now than when Congress chose to delegate the authority in the first place. And so until you change that, I think, or at least convince Congress that there are other factors that outweigh that concern that mean it should try to bring back more power for itself, it's going to be a hard road to slog.
Anyone else? Oh, back there.
I kind of feel this was a topic taken up earlier. Is there any learning about whether there are, setting aside the question of earmarks per se, is there any learning about whether there are more lines, fewer lines, in other words, are there bigger buckets these days, smaller buckets into which appropriations flow, the appropriation, whether you do it for this or that sub, process or sub-object is not being technical, but that's a power of Congress. Once it gets there, it gets divided up by the executive branch, right? Depending on how the CBJ is structured.
Rather than answer the question the way you posed it, I'm going to suggest looking at other national models, because other countries have spent a lot of time trying to rationalize the way they organize the accounts and their programs, and to make them align better. For example, France a few years ago decided they would have 130 programs, each with a clear mission, and then those were the buckets then that for appropriations. And within each of those programs, there was a considerable amount of managerial discretion about how to spend the resources. So they consolidated into a smaller number of buckets, gave more discretion administratively to the, and therefore more accountability for the use of the resources to the people running each program. Canada also has tried to align its programs more with the missions and policy goals of the government on a sustained basis. We have a rather chaotic structure here where accounts don't align with programs. Sometimes an account's funds multiple programs, sometimes multiple programs are funded out of a single or vice versa. And we just haven't sorted this out. And I think despite a mandate from Congress in the GPRA Modernization Act to tell Congress how many programs the government has and what those are, OMB's basically punted on that and said to the agencies, you tell us how many programs you have, and that'll be the that'll be the definition of programs that you live with. So there's no uniform definition even of a program in our system. So that's something that could be reformed. It could be changed. It would take a heck of a lot of work. I'm not sure what the payoff would be, but something to think about.
Anyone else? Well, I just want to say thank you to our panelists. With any final thoughts from either of you? All right, that is the final word. Thank our panelists. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Anne. Steve and Molly, we really appreciate the conversation today. If you're interested in more conversations like this, I invite you to listen to our or tune into our Necessary and Proper podcast, which is available anywhere you can get your regular podcasts. Also, our website is articleinitiative.org. If you have ideas for future events, we'd love to have them. Please send us via email, articlei@fedsoc.org. Thank you very much.